Hello and welcome to Aerial Evolution. I'm Jane.
And I'm Rowan. With us today is Deb Pope, hailing from New Zealand. Deb did the thing many of us long to do. She ran away and joined the circus. Well, kind of. We'll let her tell it as she paints a colorful picture of those early days and what it took to get going as one of the very first aerialists in London. Deb has had an amazing career, including performing all over the world on some of the largest stages as well as avant-garde ones, and is now finding more fulfillment than ever through teaching.
If you like what you hear and want to join in on the discussion, find us on Instagram or Facebook at Aerial Evolution Pod. We would love to hear from you. And if you want more info on what was discussed, make sure to check out the links in the show notes.
We are really interested in finding out more about the origins of aerial and circus and how this all came to be. And we haven't talked to anybody in New Zealand, so you're our first, which we're very excited about. We've done a fair amount of research and we haven't been able to find a lot of written history.
That's the problem with circus in many ways anyway. And to a certain extent, our generation is kind of rewriting it because we are the generation that's writing a sort of contemporary history. It wasn't written down before, no. It is now studied, and yeah, I don't know whether Lindsay mentioned her, but Pauline Palassi, well, she's somebody that really crossed over the traditional to contemporary, so she would be in her, I'm in my mid-60s, she's in her 70-somethings now. She actually taught us, and we were probably the first generation, and certainly in the UK, the sort of first new contemporary generation, so yeah.
Wonderful. We'd like to get started with how you got started with circus and aerial and, you know, what drew you to it.
Okay. So brief background. I am actually a New Zealander and I ran away from New Zealand to travel the world as all New Zealanders do. And I traveled for a year or so in America and then I got to England and I didn't really know what I wanted to do in my life. And I managed to get into a squat because the early 80s in England, so socially, politically, there was a lot of upheaval. A lot of circus history can actually be related to social and political changes at the time. And certainly all over Europe, there was this kind of socialization of the arts, so street theatre, puppetry, mime, all of that kind of stuff. And of course, it's not the reinvention of circus, but it was kind of the discovery of the physical skills. And during the 50s, of course, you know, with television, circuses had died certainly in England. So I got to England, it was Thatcher government, which probably people that are English will understand. It was a depression. She was a very harsh prime minister. There was a lot of political unrest, but there was also a growth in the arts and in feminism and feminist companies and all that kind of thing. So from my squat, I saw an advertisement to do some acrobatic classes, female, run by a company who are called the Cunning Stunts. Now, they are quite famous in the 70s. They were a feminist physical theatre group, and they were outrageous. You can read about them in quite a lot of the history of theatre. Anyway, they were running this acrobatic group, and I thought that I could do acrobatics because I was a bit fat. I'd got fat in England, and I might lose some weight. End of story, never really thought about it at all in my life or anything like that. And the thing was that I loved it. I was good at it. That really surprised me as well. The women were really nice. And the woman that was teaching it said to me, you should come to my teacher in Brixton. And this was an amazing man called Eugene Baller. He was an old Hungarian circus acrobat who'd toured with the circuses, been in Spain with the circus in the Spanish Civil War. He had this amazing history as well of circus. He'd ended up in London. He would have been at least in his 70s, late by then. He'd knocked a hole through two rooms, put up, wrote a lunge line. He'd lit the room with a fire and all number of artists who became subsequently very much part of an avant-garde move in England, or London particularly, went and trained there to learn the skills. He was an old master and a mentor. And also it was a place where I met people. So I then met a beautiful dancer who was also a gymnast, Helen Crocker, and she was interested in circus as well too. And at that stage, when we were talking about it, it sounds very funny, but Sue Broadway, who would be another major player in the history of what I would call contemporary aerial work, came to England to work with the Cunning Stunts feminist. She'd already started Circus Oz in Australia. So they were very advanced in comparison to England in terms of having contemporary circus. So she came to England to work with the Cunning Stunts, and it just so happened that she was in a woman's squat just down the road from me, and she said to Helen Crocker and I, would you like to learn some trapeze? And we went, yes. And actually, I suppose, from there, we had to learn a lot of things. There was nothing. We had to learn to make the gear. We had to learn to rig the gear. We had to learn to buy the equipment to do it. We had to find places to train. And out of all that, I think trying to answer all of those things is how the circus space in London grew, all of the first circus school, all of those things, they came holistically. It's an organic growth, which I can see has repeated in New Zealand in this last 15 years. So this is where I live now and have been involved in the circus movement here. So the funniest story is probably it was very difficult to find places to rig anything, and we didn't really know what rigging meant. We had to learn it, but we knew it was serious and that we had to take it quite seriously. And as any rigger will tell you now, as have the skills grown and specialised in circus, of course, so has all of the rigging and the technology. So from the simplicity of what we were doing, which was rigging one single rope or one trapeze 2-point, you know, we have computerised flying and amazing things happening now. And the gear is completely specialised and has been really well developed with lots of money. There's been money put into it. However, 40 years ago, it wasn't like that at all. It wasn't unsafe, but we were learning, and it was simple. There was a bit much of simplicity to it, I suppose. So we got a gig in what was a really well-known cabaret, Jongleurs, in Battersea in London. And we knew that we had to rig off a big beam, but there was a plaster ceiling in the beam. But because it was London, it was a beautiful old venue, but of course there were holes in the plaster. So we actually bashed some more holes in the plaster to put our trapezes up. Actually, what we ended up doing subsequently was having a shower of plaster dust fall on us through this act, but that wasn't really, at least it didn't fall down. This is just to sort of illustrate, and really we were very green, and in traditional circus at that stage was still very much family, so you know, they taught within the family. The skills remained at that stage very much within family and other people like that. Well, we didn't know how we could rehearse either. So we put some bolts in my living room in Islington in London. And then the only way we could rehearse our double act was to hang the trapeze up really high and practice the bottom half underneath the bar, and then drop the trapeze down and practice the top bit. And yeah, that was pretty funny too. So I suppose we really pushed boundaries for us then. We got ourselves involved in all the cabarets, and now it's de rigueur to see circus and cabaret and stuff like that. And then it's mostly stand up and a few mimes, and we would push to get our double trapeze act into circus. And then I think we realised that it was an amazing form, and that the next most important thing really was a training space. If you didn't, we didn't have any skills or anything like that, but a place to be able to train. So London was a very different place. There were lots of empty spaces, and it's not a city. You couldn't find these kind of empty spaces in central London anymore. Jonathan Graham was amazing, and we found a huge warehouse space, which meant that we could set up rigging and we could teach, which means as soon as you start teaching, of course, from youth upwards, you increase your audience, you increase your skills, all sorts of things. And so it also gave us a place to train and finally actually increase our skills from incredibly basic skills. We were able to find amazing teachers who actually knew how to do it properly. And so we learned some actual technique, because we didn't really. So Pauline Palassi, she was very amazing in teaching technique, which then meant that we could increase our skills. At that stage, that connection in England, we had a lot of internationals. So for me, Rodrigo Mateus, who was a Brazilian who'd came to England, and we wanted to do something really different. He had the skills as well too. So we created a double trapeze act called Solemn Gestures, and we didn't really want to have any real tricks in it. It was a story of a man and a woman in a dangerous relationship, basically. So this was in the early 90s, and we were trying to do theatre outside. And we took that act to railway stations and festivals, and it certainly wasn't a skills-based act, but it was incredibly well received. So the appetite was really changing as well. And the audience, certainly in England and Europe, were getting more educated about circus. And circus is an art form, not just a skill, but an art form capable of, you know, moving people and, yeah, all of that kind of thing, as well as entertaining them.
So is this more circus as opposed to combined with dance?
My personal opinion is that contemporary circus is just wrapped around the basics of traditional circus, really. And that just like any art form, there have been huge developments. We were interested in dance, theatre, movement, in abstract ideas and images and creating visual theatre with the skills, even outside and outdoors. So we didn't really rely heavily on the skills. We used a lot of contemporary dance to try and reinvent a language in double trapeze. And I think that we did a really amazing job looking back on it. And we had an amazing 10, 15 years, Rodrigo and I. And there were lots of other people as well who were, yeah, reinventing the moves. And they were invested in something in the same way that you would choreograph a contemporary dance, but they were placed 20, 30 feet up in the air. And the music was really cool. I wore a dress sort of thing, and, you know, it was a piece of theatre as much as it was a trapeze act, which it was at the same time, yeah. That's the kind of work I suppose I was involved in the 90s, was the art form and really crossing over. So I tried to take my skills into as many other art forms. So I worked a lot in opera, and I was privileged enough to have this choreographer who just would give me these parts and these things and go, okay, what can you do with this? Which was really quite amazing. Circus, and there has often been circus in opera, namely written parts, and now they can use it to create big visual scenes and skills. They use circus skills as well. So I was very lucky to have been in the early stages of that. And in fact, I worked with the Washington Opera, did a big season with the Washington Opera, and really enjoyed that 6 weeks. So I've done a few like that, the Royal Opera, the English National Opera, the National Theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Company. So I was looking at how you could take the skills into art form. And then I suppose the next bit of my practices in areas was then to bring those skills back into my practice as well, making shows. And then they got larger spectacles and festivals and, you know, so, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. It's been a pretty varied career, I'll say that, and a very global career. That's a wonderful thing about circus, because it's, even though it was not strong in England and it's definitely not part of the culture in New Zealand and many other countries in the world, there's circus, so you can go anywhere in the world, and if you've got the skills and you're really interested, then you can communicate and teach and move people. So we had some amazing, I toured widely in Brazil with Rodrigo, and China, and Africa, and all sorts of places where we were able to actually communicate with people in a very different way. So it's a privilege. It's been a privilege.
You bring a new perspective to this podcast, being from New Zealand. What is your experience and understanding of the development of circus there?
I suppose for me now, my perspective, and I did warn you, my perspective on circus is, it's really interesting. So if you look at Australia and New Zealand, I think Australia was colonised by working class English who brought music hall and circus skills to Australia. And as well as that, it had a lot of Southern European immigration. So that brought another range of skills post-war and all of that. New Zealand was really colonised by Scottish Protestants. So circus was definitely not part of the tradition here. There hasn't been a strong history here at all, or recognition of it. So when I got back here 15 years ago, having been kind of in these amazing places, and by 2000 circus had really grown in Europe, and, you know, I mean, we were growing at the same time as Cirque du Soleil. If you just look at the growth of Cirque du Soleil from, you know, I think we were in LA at the International Arts Festival with Cirque du Soleil in 1985. I was there with a small English company called Ra Ra Zoo, and Cirque were doing their very first tented show, I think. There you go. So that growth was phenomenal in the next, from 85 to 2000, and they raised the profile, but it was happening all over the world as well too, but not in New Zealand. So when I got back here, it was really, there was a circus school that I'd helped initiate, but it had closed because we get earthquakes here. And it's a small country, New Zealand, so struggled to get pupils because people didn't know very much. There's no national company. The entertainment was only international circus companies. So when I came back here, I looked for, again, almost repeated the pattern. I think there is an organic growth pattern. So I kind of looked for a training space, very much like the same kind of thing that we'd done in England, you know, 25 years ago. Found a training space from there. We were able to start kids' classes and teach young adults. Then companies grew. They had somewhere to train. So in the growth of contemporary circus, if you look at it from 2000 but earlier, the growth of education and circus as a business, and so it's raised specialist boundaries, the technical boundaries and everything. So now you've got, you know, the number of schools in Montreal and in Canada, and France has been producing amazingly talented circus artists. Their school, I think, opened 1984-85, all happening at the same time. And these schools have now developed, you know, amazing skills in the practitioners, I suppose. So the next thing I decided to do was start a course here, because, of course, unless you can have a three-year course, then you're not going to be able to get the standard of skills. The circuses really, like anything else, requires, and you know, way more than 3 years of training. So I started a school, a BA, a performing arts degree, which meant that students could get funding to go and they didn't have to work. You know, there's a number of models to learning circus, and mine wasn't like that. I actually worked and did courses, and then so I apprenticed myself in little bursts. But I've seen the advantages of the education and the school. So I started school. That lasted for 5 years, and in actual fact, just last year it was closed due to, well, I would say lack of foresight and education, but mostly to do with money, because as soon as education becomes a business and it's based on the number of students that come in, then it's going to be cut. And circus is a small, expensive discipline to teach, art form to teach, because as the teaching is often one-to-one. You know, you need big spaces. I'm sure you know all of those reasons. So that course closed at the end of last year. And it's generated a lot. I mean, there's a good industry in New Zealand, and it is developing, and they're young and they're talented. So I have every hope that, you know, it's made a difference. And I've enjoyed it all the way. And it wasn't just me. That's the thing about circus. It's so collaborative. I stand on so many big shoulders, you know, and a lot in terms of women as well too, obviously.
That's awesome.
Stay tuned.
We'll be right back. Since you talked about teaching quite a bit, can you talk a little bit more about the changes that you've continued to see in the teaching of aerial and circus, and what you're excited about?
Well, I'd have to say that the development of the care of the body, that's not to say that the pressures on the body are not actually, the more you specialize in the skills, the more pressure you put on various areas. So, you know, definitely in terms of the knowledge, I would say that health and safety wise, it's amazing. And that's to its advantage and not. I know how to do everything, probably not very well. And a lot of my friends, if they listen to this, would throw their hands out and go, "You're so old, you're not allowed to do it anymore." However, I can make a trapeze and I can splice and I can. And those basic skills when I came to New Zealand and had to do it all again, even at 50, were really useful, knowing how, you know, I had to get it all signed off now, but I knew how to do it. I knew how to put it all together. And I learned that. I think that there is a lack of that whole knowledge around the skill for aerialists. A number wouldn't really know what they're looking for. They work on their piece of equipment. It becomes very focused like that. So I think that there's pluses and minuses to that. It's a lot safer. You can create amazing images. Generally, I still think it's probably overexposed and underdeveloped still. In terms of the art form practice. So people tend to throw the skills in your face, and actually we're educated now. It's not enough to do a half angel drop 5 feet off the ground and expect everybody to fall over. You know what I mean? It's kind of, for me anyway, there are wonderful companies that do explore and they are art form practice companies. And maybe as an artist, there is a journey that you go through too. Certainly, my journey's gone through all of the ranges of circus, I think. I think the only thing I haven't been in is a panto, but I reckon I could still be a really good dame. But anyway, so those are some of the changes, I think, definitely. I think the other thing that's a really huge change is, well, the social circus. Circus is a tool for empowerment. So the education of young and troubled young people. And I think its uses in those forms are really quite remarkable. And the development of that is actually really amazing as well, too. So, yeah.
Something that's come up a lot is circus as an empowerment tool. And that's something that I'm really interested in, is the type of people that gravitate towards it. And the sort of safe risk taking is one way I've heard it put. And I find that fascinating, how it is a way to heal.
Yes. And the other thing I've just found really fascinating, so I live in New Zealand Aotearoa, so we have a bicultural society here, and we have Māori as well, and we have a treaty, so we have to address the Treaty of Waitangi and everything that we do, including education, which means full access and participation for Māori and inclusion of Māori tikanga and practice. Now, that is actually very similar to circus practice and tikanga, in my opinion now. So my experience of the traditional and of the contemporary circus world has been warm, embracing of others, open, and respectful, disciplined, and Māori, and very much related to the word whānau, which is a word for family in Māori in New Zealand, and how the family supports all education processes. And I think that I've seen so many links between that and the tikanga, what I would call the tikanga and the practice of circus and that. And I've always encouraged that. I've had such kindness and there has been such acceptance. And I think that's something to encourage. And this last few years in New Zealand, I just realised that actually it is found in a lot of cultures, and that it's, I don't know, I just found it quite moving that in actual fact to realise that there is a tikanga, a practice, a respect about circus, and that people, if you teach that to your students, they not only respect the skill, but they respect their bodies, but they actually respect the discipline, and that in turn means the, you know, the sort of world in a more general and holistic practice, I suppose. So not just the social empowerment, because I think it does wonderful things in all of those fields, but even just the teaching of it to anybody, for me, has so much involved in the deep teaching of circus. Yeah. So it's, for me now, it's fairly boring to teach the skills. I don't. I teach the person, though, and that's what my teacher, the old Hungarian guy, said to me, was that, you know, Debbie, you don't teach the skill, you teach the person. Because everybody receives information and, you know, in such a different way. So it's taught me a lot.
Interesting.
Yeah, all of it. It's been an amazing life. And, yeah, the teaching has always been part of the performance and the practice, really, because as any artist, you're not always going to be, and particularly in circus, one has to make one's own work all the time. Certainly through my age of circus, we made every single gig. It wasn't probably until, 2000 that I was, maybe a little bit earlier, I was being offered work in a really, you know, big way. Up until then, you made your own work, which was very exciting as well as exhausting. But as Mark said, though, you had control over your product, and that's not a bad thing to have, you know.
Yeah.
And if you control the means of production, yeah, that was it. Anyway, so there's a lot of things in my exploration of circus, actually. It's not just a skill-based discipline for me at all. You know, there's a lot of social, political connections that I've made over my lifetime, and it's kept me interested, actually.
That is really interesting.
Yeah, it is. It is.
You said you're still teaching. Are you still performing?
Oh, it's funny, isn't it? No, and I'm not one of those people that was too bothered. I think I did a bit of a swinging act to make some money at corporate about in my early 50s. Was the last thing I did, and it doesn't bother me. I'm not one of those people. I had a really amazing time, but in actual fact, I went on to directing, and, you know, just creating in a more amazing way. And again, you're empowering others, because most circuses devised. It's not, as you said, there's very little, or there was very little written with even the shows that, you know, they're not really written down. So it's quite an interesting discipline on that level. You kind of, it's a lot of devising and creativity around a show, and that requires finding things in the people that you're working with, which is always an amazing process. So no, I didn't really miss the performing that much at all. You know, I think there was a sense you had to have something to say. I haven't been bothered. I haven't found anything I really wanted to say. Importantly, they haven't been able to say through the shows I've made, or even the teaching and the work that my students have been subsequent, or even in their lives, you know, they've gone on and done it. And that's just great in many ways. I mean, in some ways, I'm saying this to somebody else, we all think that the performance of it, you know, the applause is absolutely wonderful. We can never get a higher pinnacle. But to be perfectly honest, teaching, much as it can be a bit of a bitch, excuse my French sometimes, it's sort of like the gift that keeps on giving, because, you know, I've taught people for the last 30 odd years and I still get these people, you know, messaging and going, oh, well, you do. So it's kind of a lovely thing, and it is a bit of a gift that keeps on giving, I think. For me, it has been anyway. So, yeah.
That's lovely.
There was a really interesting thought that you had in there, and I wanted to just kind of circle back on it. You mentioned circus as being an aspect of devised theater. I've never heard anybody else connect those two dots. So thank you for that.
Oh, that's fine. Look, it takes longer, though.
Oh, yeah. Devised pieces could take forever.
That's right. That's the thing about circus. Parameters, which we realized, you know, you can devise or make theater in 4 weeks, maybe, and then you put it on, because that relationship to the audience doesn't really change. However, in circus, it has humor and all of the emotions. By the time you get to 4 weeks, it's still not long enough. And the first 2 weeks of running it in front of an audience, because an audience has such an effect. In circus, there's not a fourth wall, even if there is. Mm. So it takes so much longer to make a devised circus show. I experimented a bit with, as we all do, with form, because the traditional form of circus, the act form and the circular nature of it, is actually wonderful. And you can't really beat that as a kind of form. It doesn't suit theatre. Theatre doesn't have such a circular narrative, or that, you know, you want to go somewhere else with circus. It has a very different kind of peaks and trough, I think, journey. And it's not written down, so I'm not the kind of director that writes everything down. I think people do have visions. I'm very much more of a collaborative person and interested in a collaborative vision. And that's a much slower process, of course. And it gets refined. That's the other thing about it. It is continually changing and being refined, I think, a show like that, you know. So it does mean that the history of circus is not written down. And subsequent to what we do have now, this technological world has changed that completely, everything. So you can learn to do a trick online, and there's all that information. When we didn't even know, there was only television, so we couldn't research anything apart from, I've got one Soviet book in Russian here that we managed to get from somebody, and it had pictures in it of tricks. So when we were starting, there was no resources whatsoever apart from traditional circus teachers and the people you could meet. And even in right through the 80s and the 90s, it was all big VHSs that you had to copy and send out to people around the world in the hope that they might look at it in the same format and maybe get back to you via, of course, you know, a phone call in the middle of the night or a fax. So I think access to the market and access to the range of the skills has vastly increased. My students all troll the internet and YouTube, and there's an advantage and a disadvantage to that, because the replication of the trick is not, you know what I mean, it's very easy to replicate any trick. That's not, in my mind, what circus is really about for me. And I don't think the learning process is just in replication. There's a learning process in the repetition and the discipline, but the next learning process is actually finding how you can change that thing into something that is yours. And that's a really important part of the process, whether that represents your ideas, you, whatever, you know. So, yeah, that's where I have been at with circus. I'm not doing a lot now. I'm sort of in a, to be perfectly honest, after nearly 40 years in circus, and I'm in a kind of, I don't know what I really want to do next with circus, and I can see that there's a lot of, particularly in New Zealand, there's a lot of young people that are going to pick up the baton. So that's good. And I worry about the rest of the world because, you know, millions of people are out of work in our business, and that's just terrible, awful, and it's going to be quite a long time before that gets back. However, I think circus artists are really resilient. Circus is a really resilient art form. It doesn't need to be in theatres. It doesn't even need to be in a tent. It could be outside on the street, and you know what I mean? So there is a number of ways that it can be reinvented, I think, to for this kind of new world. So that would be my hope for the art form, really. And actually, just between you and me, I'm quite glad that we're not being swamped by huge, large American circus type shows that are spectacle, that there might be a chance for the smaller, beautiful things to actually come out of the holes and shine, I suppose. So that might be one advantage. I mean, I know there's millions of people employed, and it's an entertainment as a business and all of that kind of thing. And I think as well, look at schools as a business and look at churning out loads and loads of people for whom there's no work, because now, you know, in terms of that high end of the market, you know, it's not like my day. There were three aerialists in London, and one of them was me in the early 80s, and I could say that with complete aplomb for at least 1 year or two. But you know what I mean? I think there's a responsibility too to at least train with a large range of transferable skills, I think. So, you know, that people who do arts degrees end up with many transferable skills. And I think that's just how we have to look at circus schools now as well too, and not quite so specialized.
So you mentioned when you were starting, you know, a couple of the people that you were training with. Is there a person or an event or a performance? Is there something in particular that has influenced you throughout your career?
To be perfectly honest, there have been so many people and so much generosity, and I only hope that I have passed that on in my life. But I went to Paris in the early 80s, and I went to the on my own. It was, you know, I was in my, I guess I was in my 20s and early 20s, and on my own in Paris. And I went to do some circus training with the Palassis in Flying Trapeze. Anyway, while I was there, I went to a theatre called the Bouffe du Nord, which is a famous theatre in Paris that Peter Brook ran. So he was, if you know about Peter Brook in the 60s, he did the Mahabharata, and he actually included circus skills. So he used to trapeze, and he was a really amazing director who probably revolutionized a global kind of look at theatre. And anyway, he wasn't accepted in England, so he was funded in Paris and funded by the French government, where he did all his work at this theatre called the Bouffe du Nord. Anyway, it was a very tall, three-storey, wrecked old building with a kind of central, not unlike a Colosseum or a kind of stage. And the show I went to see was a show called Freaks, which I think you'll all remember the 1936 Freaks, the movie, the black and white movie. It's absolutely famous. And if nobody's seen it, then that's really, it is an amazing movie. So this was a stage show of this movie, and it was directed by a female trapeze artist. And that really struck a nerve with my feminist consciousness. And it was an amazing show on three levels, and it used a lot of physical disability, the whole premise of it. And that was the beginning of our chaos. I don't know whether, so this inclusion of mixed abilities and that sideshow element into the circus in Europe. Anyway, it was amazing show, and I came away from that thinking, I want to do that. I want to do that. And if she can do that, I can do that. But any woman could do that. That's fine, right? I'm going to do that. I mean, I certainly never achieved a show like that because it was just quite remarkable. But yeah, I would say looking back on it, that was quite an amazing moment in a number of big moments. Yeah.
You've talked about some of the different projects you've worked on throughout your career, but is there one either that you've already mentioned perhaps, or one that you haven't mentioned yet that you would consider a favorite?
Nope. I've had so many amazing experiences. There are pieces of work that I'm very proud of, but I've also realized in life, so I've been at the cutting edge and I've done amazing work that's been really emotional, and I've created beautiful and whatever. But every job every bit has its own learning, wonderful moment in it. And while as a young woman with loads of ego, I would have gone, well, maybe taking a bow on stage at the Royal Opera House or making 2,000 people cry because of this trapeze act that we did in Brazil in an amphitheater. You know, now I probably go, wow, I changed that kid's life in the teaching. I don't really mean to say, because mine was only a small part of the process of changing that person's life, whoever they were. But to be able to be part of that is actually, you know, it's like I said, it's the gift. So I appreciate those things probably more now as I get older, I think. Yeah, pretty lucky to have all of them. I mean, I've been very lucky in that my career grew with the growth of contemporary circus. And there's probably a number of people that would say that in their lives. And I really embraced it. And I've got a lot back from it as well, too.
It's beautiful. Yeah, well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
No, I really enjoyed it as well. I don't often talk about it now because, you know, life's moved on. So you never know what you've learned, actually, really. I think that's the amazing thing. One just keeps on learning, and that's an incredible thing too. So I'm lucky. Yeah, no, thanks. It was wonderful.
Thank you so much.
All right. Ciao.
Bye.
Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Aerial Evolution. Next time, on our season one finale, we will be discussing a brand new topic, vertical dance. So we are calling in an expert, Italian vertical dancer Vonda Moretti, who literally wrote the book on it.
And we would love to hear from you. If you have questions or comments about this episode, come and find us on Instagram or Facebook at Aerial Evolution Pod. And both those links will be in the show notes as well. And stay tuned for future episodes with other amazing aerialists releasing every 2 weeks. Until next time.